Today on Against the Grain. As the plight of the Palestinians, many of them refugees in their native lands, dominates world headlines, we take a look at the ways that international policy, through entities like the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, has not been driven by altruistic motives. Instead, as historian Laura Robson argues, much of what takes place under the guise of humanitarian assistance has served to keep a lid on displaced populations while profiting from their captive labor. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. From its inception, writes Laura Robson, internationalist refugee policy was designed to treat refugees as simultaneously a threat to be contained and a resource to be exploited. In Human Capital, A History of Putting Refugees to Work, which is published by Verso, Laura Robson looks back at over a century of refugee policy and concludes that what appears as charity has actually been motivated by the political and economic interests of great powers and their client states. She also argues that the Middle East, from the end of the Ottoman Empire to the formation of the State of Israel and the dispossession of the Palestinians, has frequently been at the center of international refugee policymaking. A professor of history at Penn State University, she's the co-founder and co-editor of Stateless Histories. Robson's other books include The Politics of Mass Violence in the Middle East. Laura, most of us imagine that when people are displaced on a large scale, such as by war, refugee policies through the auspices of entities like the United Nations are there to protect the vulnerable in the midst of terrible crisis. Why does that not capture what's at the heart of what you call the international refugee regime?
So I think there are two basic answers to that. And one is about time period, and the other is about the nature of the post-war regime that set up some of those legal norms. So we tend to think, as you're suggesting, that the international refugee regime was a consequence of the Second World War, and the institutions under that fall under the UN, and particularly the UNHCR, which is the global institution that deals with most of the world's refugees. We tend to think of that as a kind of starting point for international refugee policy and law. But actually, it has a much longer genealogy that goes back to the late 19th century and is really rooted in empire, is really rooted in how empires thought about making use of displaced people for labor, for the extension of state power, for their own purposes. So that's one answer. And the other is that when we think about that post-war regime that begins with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and includes the Refugee Convention of 1951, it was explicitly designed to deal almost exclusively with white Europeans. And it made many fairly explicit efforts to exclude other forms of displacement and other kinds of displaced communities. And so that's the legal basis on which the system continues to rest, and it leaves by now a vast majority of displaced people out of its protection.
We'll discuss how the policies around refugees, what it looks like now, and especially the component of using refugee labor. But I wonder if you could just sum up in a nutshell what it looks like now in terms of the kinds of expectations and infrastructure that is put in place for refugees now, given that obviously this is very complex and you've just flagged all of that for us. How are refugees put to work through these organizations and entities that we assume are protecting them? And what does that look like in our day and age?
So currently, most of our refugee policy is built around the principles of containing refugees so that they cannot reach the shores of North America or Western Europe and ask for asylum there. And so international refugee institutions partner with host countries, which are usually in the global south and receive financial remuneration for their efforts, to place refugees in settlements, sometimes in camps, in restricted areas, areas of restricted movement, where they will essentially not be able to travel further. So this is particularly true in the Middle East and East Africa, other places around the globe. And there's a kind of secondary interest then in making use of these refugees as cheap mobile labor. This takes different forms in different places and moments. But for instance, in the current moment, refugees from Syria have been put to work under kind of work schemes for refugees in Eastern Jordan, doing things like manufacturing, garment manufacturing and other kind of factory work. So this is a way of kind of simultaneously trying to encourage what they call refugee productivity and create new venues for partnerships with host countries, with corporations that will make refugee hosting seem more appealing.
And what sort of labor protections, if any, do these refugees have? I mean, presumably, since they're refugees, they're not organized into trade unions or other types of worker protections that come from below. Are there any worker protections from on high?
No, there are very few worker protections of any kind. I will note that there's a kind of irony to this situation, though, which is that refugees, as a category of migrant, do, at least in theory, have greater international protection under the law than other kinds of migrants, than labor migrants, for instance. So actually, there have been cases where host countries are reluctant to accept refugees as workers precisely because they fear that they will have access to legal protections that people who are categorized as labor migrants or economic migrants don't have, even though in practice that's usually not the case. So there are some real ironies to the fact that refugee status can sometimes appear to confer protections on people that they actually cannot access in any meaningful way.
Well, let's turn to the origins of refugee policy, which you alluded to at the beginning, saying that the kind of policies and framework that govern how refugees are treated did not come out of the world wars, but actually out of colonialism. Can you tell us about those origins in the Ottoman Empire?
So I think this is a particularly interesting kind of aspect of this inquiry because people do think about humanitarian refugee policy as having its origins in Europe, and we can question how humanitarian these policies actually are. But in fact, the first state to have a formal refugee policy of any kind was the Ottoman Empire in the late 19th century, which dealt with enormous numbers of people who had been displaced out of the Balkans and the Caucasus into Anatolia, what's now modern day Turkey, as a consequence of the kind of wars of the late 19th century. So mostly Muslims who had been displaced into Anatolia as a consequence of these local acts of violence. And the Ottoman Empire thought about these populations as a burden in certain respects, but also as potentially useful for the imperial state. And so they constructed a series of policies around them that involved moving them to remote areas, placing them in agricultural colonies, using them as imperial military forces. Making use of them in a variety of ways to kind of spread state power, often in areas where it was not particularly thoroughly established. So this is really the origin, I think, of a lot of later ideas about how refugees could serve in useful roles for their host states. And we can see some of the eventual iterations of that in the interwar regime surrounding displaced people, the League of Nations, and then eventually, I would argue, also at the UN.
Well, tell us about that. So, the League of Nations coming out of World War I, how did the policies of the West then take those sort of notions about how to deal with refugees and expand them?
So the first thing to note is that one of the reasons the Ottoman model is so important for the League of Nations is because the League actually held a degree of political authority over the post-war Middle East, some of the ex-Ottoman territories, in the form of what it called the mandate system, which was a kind of internationally approved colonialism headed up by Britain and France. So they had the capacity, the League of Nations, kind of via the mandate system and via British and French colonial authority, had a lot of physical and political and military capacity to move people around in the, you know, the Eastern Mediterranean, the Arabic speaking Eastern Mediterranean. And they thought of it as a kind of space of experiment for figuring out what to do with displaced populations and how they could be used to prop up struggling colonial enterprises. So there are a couple of crucial displaced communities in the post-war Middle East. One is Armenians, survivors of the genocide who had landed mostly in Syria after the war. And they were often deployed by the French in rural areas of Syria, particularly in the Jazeera, to bolster French authority, to develop agriculture, to develop industry, to mark the borders of the Syrian mandate state. The same is true for Assyrian communities in Iraq, who were concentrated in the area around Mosul, who had been moved there during the war, actually, in large part by the British, and were deployed as colonial militias for British interests, but also as oil workers and also as kind of agricultural developers in remote parts of what became Iraq. So there are ways in which, you know, the Ottoman model is clearly influencing how the British and the French and the League think about these communities and then develop their ideas about the use of refugees as laborers in colonial settings for this kind of new era of European control.
World War II led to tremendous displacement, and the United States became, at that point, the sort of indisputed power of the West. How did Franklin Delano Roosevelt, often lauded for the New Deal, see immigration during World War II? And I wonder if you could tell us about his M project, M standing, of course, here for migration.
So this was in some ways the kind of origin point for this book, because this is a very, you know, a little known episode in FDR's career and political life. And it came out of his participation in the Evian Conference of 1938, which was a conference called to among about 30, more than 30 countries came together in this French spa town, essentially, to try to think about what they thought of as solutions for the problem, the increasing problem of Jews who were being displaced from Nazi-controlled Germany. And part of the reason this was an issue was that these people actually didn't fall under the legal category of refugee as the League of Nations had defined it. And also that this was a period of essentially kind of closed doors in terms of immigration to North America and Western Europe. And Roosevelt himself made many, multiple anti-Semitic statements about Jewish immigration into North America. He himself was wary of immigration in general terms and wanted to find some sort of solution to this displacement that did not involve opening the US's doors to immigrants, and particularly Jewish immigrants. So the idea of the M Project came out of, you know, there was this kind of population politics of the interwar period, which thought about, it's closely connected in some respects to eugenics movements, and thought about kind of moving people around so that they would fit labor markets, they would fit climates, they would kind of, that there was this modernist possibility of organizing communities around the needs of economies. And the key figure here was an American geographer named Isaiah Bowman, who was one of the architects, early architects anyway, of the M Project. And his idea was that refugees could be put to work in American interests in what he called pioneer areas, mostly in Latin America, as a kind of extension of American power that would not actually require entrance into the United States. And so the M Project, which was a classified project that ran throughout the war, produced all of these studies about how to, the kind of possibilities for moving displaced communities into various parts of the world for deployment as laborers. And it was a very thoroughly conceived project in some ways and poorly conceived project in others. But it forms a lot of the basic, it is a venue for formulating a lot of the basic assumptions about how what refugees really need is work, and that work can serve the cause of industrial capitalism and particularly the American-led variety by placing refugees in the places where the superpowers would like to see them. That is mostly in kind of colonial and neo-colonial areas. So it's really a very interesting moment, and one that has been kind of under-recognized and understudied both in the context of refugee histories and in the context of Roosevelt's own career.
Historian Laura Robson is my guest. We're discussing her book, Human Capital, A History of Putting Refugees to Work. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, you mentioned Jewish refugees, and I wanted to ask you if you could back up and talk about the notions around both displaced people and colonialism that in many ways came to a head in Palestine, Israel, you know, a place where refugee policy has been absolutely crucial for the creation of a nation state, with one set of refugees making refugees out of the native inhabitants. I wonder if you could just start by talking about the early history of Zionist ideas about the Jewish population and the Palestinians and how that was seen by Western powers.
So this is a particularly interesting place to start as well, because you can back up even, you know, to the early years of Zionism, when Palestine was not the only possibility for where the Jewish national home, to use the words of the Balfour Declaration, could be located. And so we see at the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, that both certain Zionist thinkers, including some of the leaders of the movement, and imperial actors, particularly from the British Empire, like the Ottomans, thought about displaced people, in this case, Jews coming out of Eastern Europe or the Russian sphere, as kind of possible partners in imperial endeavor. And so there are a number of proposals, not just to settle European Jews in Palestine, but to put them in places like Uganda, in Argentina, in South Africa, as kind of representatives, as settlers for the British colonial enterprise. And so that, I think, represents kind of an important backdrop for thinking about what happens eventually in Palestine, where we have an early British commitment beginning in 1917, which is also the year that the British invaded and occupied Jerusalem and began their colonial regime that turns into the Mandate, where the British actively made a decision to encourage Jewish settlement as a kind, European Jewish settlement, I should say, as a kind of partner to empire in Palestine and in the Middle East, kind of more generally. So throughout the interwar period, we have increased European Jewish settlement in Palestine, and particularly, of course, once we get into the 1930s, when there are existential threats to Jewish communities in Europe. I think it's worth noting that not all of these people are committed Zionists, but many people end up in Palestine because there are no other options for them. And that by the time we get to the Second World War, this development is kind of ramping up, right? By the time we get to 1948 and the war that displaces so many Palestinians and creates the State of Israel, we have a situation where Palestine has become a kind of test case for the capacities and the powers of the new internationalism in the form of the UN. And so Palestine is actually the place where refugee definitions, in some ways, are kind of hammered out. The definition of what is called the Palestine refugee, which comes into being in 1949, just after the 1948 war, is the first of these. And it is followed up by the 1951 Convention on Refugees, which is really built around the European Jewish experience of displacement and the UN's vision for what should happen to those people who have survived the war and are mostly still in what was called displaced persons camps across Europe. So this is a really kind of crucial moment in refugee policy because it introduced the idea at the level of international law that there could be different categories of refugee who would receive different kinds of protections and different levels of protections and would be acknowledged as bearing different kinds of rights. So the category of the Palestine refugee is excluded officially, formally, and explicitly from the protections of the 1951 Refugee Convention. And this is actually still the case today. It's important for the case of Palestine, but it's also important as a kind of procedural model for thinking about how international agencies can say there are different kinds of refugees from different spaces who have different kinds of rights.
And what was the logic of excluding Palestinians or putting them in their own category at that point?
It's a dual logic. One origin point is that there was resistance from Palestinians themselves and from the rest of the Arab world to thinking about them as convention refugees, as the 1951 convention, the people who fell under the convention came to be known. Because it was felt that kind of an acknowledgement of their refugee status would mitigate against some kind of political solution to the problem. But it's also a fact that the Refugee Convention was built to apply exclusively to, more or less exclusively to Europeans. And part of the reason for that is that there was little appetite for resettling people who there was not that much appetite for even resettling European refugees, but there was even less appetite for the idea of eventually having to resettle what would become known as decolonial refugees or as new refugees from other parts of the world. So Palestinians are excluded from the 1951 convention in very explicit terms, but in practice, so are, for instance, people who were displaced in the partition of India or people who were displaced in places like Hong Kong. Or later, people who were displaced in the decolonial conflicts in Africa. So Palestinians are kind of a model for the for that those kinds of distinctions.
Well, staying with Palestine and Israel, in the last 6 months, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, has been very much in the news. Can you tell us about the formation of that agency within the United Nations and what it oversaw for the Palestinians?
So UNRWA fits very clearly into this model of thinking about refugees as laborers. As you point out, the letters stand for Relief and Works Agency, and the works was an important part of what it saw itself initially as doing. So after the War of 1948, the UN made a decision that the so-called Palestine question would be dealt with in two separate ways. And the first would be through UNRWA, which would be a purely humanitarian, in its own terms, operation providing shelter, water, assistance, aid to displaced Palestinians on a theoretically temporary basis. And this responsibility was segregated from the idea of providing some sort of political answer to Palestinian displacement, which was placed under the auspices of a different commission called the UNCCP, which operated for a couple of years before essentially kind of throwing up its hands and saying, you know, we have no basis for a political solution to this issue. So one of the things that happens with UNRWA is that it becomes a body that is only about aid provision. It cannot advocate for solutions. It cannot participate in political discussions. It cannot position itself as an advocate for Palestinian rights in any meaningful way. It can only provide aid in place. That's what it does. And even that is theoretically temporary. This is in fact still true, even though UNRWA has been operating for more than 7 decades, it still has to be re-upped. Its mandate has to be re-upped in the General Assembly every few years. So UNRWA is a really, in some ways, kind of an anomalous organization. It's the only standing UN agency that only deals with one national group of refugees. And the way that it is constituted as a state in certain respects, providing state-like services for Palestinians, is significantly at odds with the way that it's kind of, it was forbidden from engaging with any sort of political agenda from its inception. So it has a lot of peculiarities in how it has operated. And I would argue that part of the idea behind UNRWA was that it would exclude the political as a way of containing Palestinian claims on an initially temporary, but fairly soon less temporary, medium to long-term basis.
Can you sort of paint a picture of how UNRWA oversaw the work of Palestinian refugees, dispossessed Palestinians in the Middle East, and the relationship of UNRWA to a notion that these refugees might be useful in industrialization of the region?
Yeah, so initially, part of UNRWA's setup was entangled with an American endeavor that was called the CLAP Report, which was about economic development in the Middle East as a whole. And so it identified spaces of kind of putative industrial development across the Arab states, particularly Jordan, but other places, Egypt, other places as well. And it proposed kind of making use of Palestinian refugees as workers in those spaces. This met a lot of resistance from refugees themselves, who saw it correctly, I would say, as an effort to just resettle them in the surrounding states and, you know, abandon their claims to their original homes or to a nationality or a state. And so gradually we see the kind of attenuation of UNRWA's attempts to place people in work in these spaces, although it does, there are lots of people who do go abroad and, you know, do work like this, including in oil industries across the Middle East. But gradually there's a kind of acceptance on the part of the Americans that this is not going to be a successful enterprise, that the resistance to refugee work is too great. And so UNRWA will be asked instead to serve as a kind of container for Palestinian nationalism. It ends up pouring most of its efforts into its educational systems, which are very highly developed in the 1950s and 1960s. And becomes a rather different kind of agency from what was originally proposed.
So, Laura, how much would you say is social control a factor in refugee policy, including with the Palestinians, the idea that a refugee population will become restless or destabilizing of the larger society?
I mean, I think it's an enormous factor. This is essentially why we have camp systems, for instance, right? These are systems of containment. There's long been a principle in quote unquote humanitarian work, and UNRWA is no exception, that material aid has the capacity to move people around or to keep them in place. This is a longstanding kind of point of agreement among refugee historians and scholars of refugee policy, that material aid has been used at least from the 1950s, but really arguably much longer than that, to keep people where they are or to move them to places where they can be contained more easily. So, you know, there really is this kind of longstanding premise that aid can serve as a mode of control. In the case of UNRWA, we see this over and over and over again in the context of American support for the agency. Historically speaking, the U.S. provided a vast majority of funds for UNRWA, as much as 70% of its funding at some points in its history. And the reason for that is not that the US is sympathetic to Palestinian needs, but rather that it viewed UNRWA as a way of keeping Palestinian claims tamped down within the region. And over again, when money for UNRWA is discussed in the US and other global powers, the line is that UNRWA is a stabilizing influence across the region, and that without it, the Palestinian question would spill over into surrounding territories in a potentially much more destabilizing way. So I think that's and further, of course, during the Cold War, there is this worry that large populations of displaced, impoverished people will be vulnerable to communism. So there's a great deal of self-interest among donor states in their funding of supposedly humanitarian enterprises like UNRWA. And donor states really have a tendency to see them as mechanisms of controlling unstable and potentially kind of flammable political situations.
I'm speaking with Laura Robson about her book, Human Capital, A History of Putting Refugees to Work. That book is published by Verso, and you can find a link to it at againstthegrain.org. She's professor of history at Penn State University. And I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been mentioning how the case of the Palestinians has in many ways shaped policies more broadly, Western policy and the policies of the international refugee regime, as you put it, shaped those policies toward other refugees. And you mentioned how in the 1950s, that there was a classification of refugees into different types, into different classes. And I wonder if you can talk about how that was done, which you mentioned was set up to exclude the Palestinians from other classifications as refugees, how this imposition or this use of classifications of different classes of refugees was then utilized during the Cold War to separate out some refugees, some less desirable refugees, from others?
So initially, we have a couple of categories of refugees that come out of that immediate post-war era. One is the, as I mentioned, the so-called Palestine refugee, which is a specific legal category in its own right. And then what were called convention refugees, which was the designation for people who fell under the 1951 Refugee Convention, which defined the refugee very specifically as someone who had been displaced prior to 1951 and usually in Europe. So that category obviously does not include anyone displaced in the later years, in the years of decolonization, other places as well. We don't see the massive numbers of refugees who are moving around the Indian subcontinent being classified under the system. There are many other places in the 1950s of mass post-war displacement who also don't fall under these categories. So we have this situation where the UN, and in particular the UNHCR, is interested in experimenting with its own power, its own institutional authority in this new era of the Cold War, and is limited in some respects by this definition of refugees as basically Europeans displaced before 1951. And so in the 1950s, in the kind of early Cold War era, we see some experimentation with the idea of the UNHCR providing aid to people who are not technically refugees. So this happens in Algeria, people who have been displaced by the Algerian War of Independence in the late 1950s, early 1960s. It also happens in Hong Kong, and it happens in Hungary. And in all of these cases, the UNHCR starts to provide material aid to people who technically don't qualify under the conventions as refugees. And they discover that material aid is actually very helpful to donor states, to the superpowers in the Cold War, because it successfully manages to contain the mass flows of displaced people that are coming out of decolonization in particular. And so this is the subject of a lot of discussion at the international level about how to rejig the refugee regime to be operational for this kind of Cold War moment. And what eventually comes out of it in 1967 is a rethinking of the Refugee Convention's definitions to define the to remove the temporal designation, right? So to say that people who are displaced after 1951 could also be refugees, but to suggest that those people who become known as new refugees or non-convention refugees will mostly be eligible for aid in place rather than legal assistance with resettlement. So this is the beginning of the kind of regime that we have now, where most forms of refugee policy have to do with material aid and the idea that a refugee, an international refugee system, is looking for ways to provide people with paths out of their geographical space is no longer one of the really, it's no longer one of the central operational principles of the system.
Well, and of course, during the large span of time that we're talking about, the way that the economic system, the global economic system, has structured itself has also changed. And in the neoliberal era, you know, since the 1970s, 80s, the situation of labor in the global economy has changed. Neoliberalism has both removed all sorts of protections or structures that might have been in place over economies, some of which extended to workers, and, you know, has been characterized as a sort of class war from above. It's also changed the way that labor has moved around globally. How has the labor that refugees have provided, if I can use that term, because often it's coercive, been needed or less needed in the context of those changes to the global economy?
I think in the 1950s, you know, in this period of the kind of massive expansion of the global economy and of industrialization after the Second World War, there was this idea that labor would be a problem, right? That we would need more and more cheap labor to keep the system in its kind of expansionist moment. And in the 1960s and 70s, there are a number of kind of reasons for this, including things like the invention of shipping containers, the idea that we can produce large numbers of, you know, that manufacturing can happen anywhere. It can be moved to the global south rather than happening in the global north. There are lots of structural reasons for this. That demand for labor begins to fall away in some respects. And so at this point, states are looking, when they think about their labor needs, they're looking for maximum flexibility. So in the 1970s, this is the era where we really begin to see explosions of guest worker programs, where people come in on kind of temporary permissions, and then that labor pool can be adjusted as necessary, right? People can be brought in and they can also be expelled, and they can be encouraged to leave in all sorts of subtle and not so subtle ways if their labor is no longer required. And this is a tricky moment in the context of the refugee regime, because it becomes broadly recognized that these sorts of guest workers, who have no rights at all, really, under international regimes dealing with migration, are better for states, are better for corporations than refugees who have, however limited, a degree of documented protection under an international system. So refugees become less useful to these states, to these enterprises, and in fact are often rejected as workers precisely because the corporations and states alike fear that they might be able to bring protections to bear that are not relevant for other kinds of migrants. So this is a point at which we still have ideas about making use of refugee labor, but it tends to happen in context of containment. So refugee work that can happen within camps, for instance, right? Refugee work that happens while people are contained in ways that doesn't threaten a kind of broader labor market structure in host countries to any significant degree. So we do have a kind of shift in the 1970s and 80s. And I would point out, I mean, this also coincides with a kind of explosion in the numbers of categories of asylum and categories of refugeedom, concepts of temporary protection, concepts of, you know, things like humanitarian right to remain. all of which are time limited, right? So we are in some ways seeing a situation where refugees are being made into something more like labor migrants in a formal legal sense.
And Laura Robson, would you say that has continued up to the present? What does it look like right now in terms of the kind of controls over the labor of refugees in the present moment?
The present moment is a reflection of all of these past trends, in that we have this kind of tremendous fragmentation of legal categories for both refugees and migrants. There have been real efforts to reduce the number of people who qualify formally for refugee protections and instead place them in categories of other kinds of categories of migration, including that of labor migrants. I would also say, I mean, if we're kind of assessing contemporary situations, I think one of the really crucial things to point out is that we're in a situation now where a vast majority of refugees around the globe are held in low to middle income host countries. So there is very little refugee hosting of any kind happening anywhere in the global north. And when we talk about, you know, this is something that I open the book talking about, that in 2015, when the EU saw this kind of influx of refugees coming in from the Middle East and elsewhere, and immediately dubbed it a crisis, this crisis, in terms of numbers, in terms of statistics, in terms of percentages, is very small compared to the numbers of people who had come into places like Lebanon or Turkey or Jordan or other parts of the global south, which do a vast majority of the hosting and have to try to think about refugee labor within already fragile economic systems. So it's become a system of both fragmentation and containment, and that containment is happening almost exclusively in the global south.
Have the wars in our period changed any of this? The war between Russia and the Ukraine, it could be argued that it's a type of proxy war between the US and Russia, and hence the US has a particular orientation toward the Ukrainian population. And you had mentioned the Cold War history of different classifications for different kinds of refugees. Can we see the shadow of that into the present?
Absolutely. I mean, it's been one of the interesting things to note over the last few years is that Ukrainian refugees, by and large, have met with a much more generous reception in the global north, particularly in Europe, than other kinds of refugees. I would say that this does certainly have Cold War echoes, but it also goes back to the 1951 convention itself, and the way that it formulated refugeedom to apply mostly to Europeans. There are clearly kind of racial politics at work here in terms of what kinds of refugees Europe is willing and not willing to absorb. But that said, I do think it points to some of the ways in which the refugee system has proven to be maybe more flexible than people imagined. That said, though, I want to note that a lot of these formulations, even relatively generous ones involving Ukrainian refugees, are still formulated on this basis of kind of temporary rights and temporary protection and temporary residencies. And so even though people are finding assistance, this has not really meant a comprehensive rethinking of refugee policy or what it's for, or the central place of work and what refugee agencies call self-sufficiency within it. So I don't think that we have seen a kind of fundamental philosophical rethinking of the underpinnings of the system, even as these wars have kind of demonstrated certain kinds of flexibility in national approaches to questions of displacement.
Historian Laura Robson is my guest. We're discussing Human Capital, a history of putting refugees to work. She is professor of history at Penn State University. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I wanted to get your take on what's happening right now with Israel's assault on Gaza. As you've illustrated, and as you write about in your book, Human Capital, the Palestinians and the State of Israel have been crucial in shaping late 20th century policy around refugees. And going further back, the Middle East has been a crucial forging ground for the dominant ideas around refugees, including refugees and labor. What is your take on what is taking place right now with the kind of assault that is happening in Gaza? How has the international view of Palestinians as workers shifted that might in some way make sense or not of what's taking place in the present?
So Gaza is an interesting case in a legal sense when it comes to the refugee regime, because it includes populations who are formerly Palestine refugees who were displaced in the 1948 or in the 1967 wars from what is now Israel or the West Bank. But it also includes people who were made stateless in 1948 but did not cross a border. And so the categories of refugee are complicated in Gaza specifically. And further, I think they point up the ways in which the Palestine refugee has very few rights internationally speaking, in particular rights to movement. So, you know, I think one of the things that's happened is that over the years, the system of containment built around the institution of UNRWA and the occupations has been conceived as a success, was a success for a long time for both kind of the global superpowers and for the state of Israel, that it was a way of confining Palestinian claims, that it essentially resulted in a kind of long-term controllable situation. I think that assumption is no longer really in place, and that when we see calls for the defunding of UNRWA and maybe even its dismantling in its entirety, what we're seeing is a replacement of the idea that these problems of displacement, maybe globally speaking, but certainly especially in the case of Palestine, can be solved over a kind of medium to long term by the use of aid and confinement, and maybe aid as confinement, and instead moving to something that looks more like straightforward destruction. So I think there is a shift happening, and that this reconsideration of kind of the role of UNRWA in controlling the Palestinian issue, that there is a conversation happening about that among donor states and in Israel, which has also been a supporter of UNRWA over the years. And that, you know, it will be telling to think about what happens next in terms of how supposedly humanitarian agencies think about their role in controlling some of the world's most intractable political problems.
And do you think something could be said about whether Palestinian workers are being seen as dispensable at this point? I mean, given the mass killing of Palestinian civilians, I mean, obviously, this isn't just a question for the refugee regime, but even Israel itself.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think Palestinians broadly are being viewed as dispensable, not just Palestinian workers. And that the idea of making use of their labor as a kind of building block of, you know, a post-Cold War economic landscape across the Middle East has been largely abandoned, at least for the present moment.
Well, I'd like to end by asking you about where this leaves us now, the degree to which UN agencies around the world continue to work with private companies, and if you feel like there are any openings for pushing back against this entire system, how do you see it?
I think that we need to stop placing our faith in the international as a kind of dispenser of social justice globally. And that one of the issues with institutions like UNRWA, with institutions like the UNHCR, is that their actions are dictated by not by the needs of their wards, not by the needs of refugees themselves, or by the claims of refugees, or by the political organizations of refugees, but rather by the needs of donor states, and secondarily, the needs of host states. And so I think that if we're looking for openings, I think those openings are nearly always much more local and specific and refugee driven, and that international law, I think one of the lessons of this book is that international law and international agencies have had very vanishingly little to offer in terms of providing displaced people with access to rights, access to political representation, access to integration, access to, their own national formulations. So I think I would like to encourage people to move away from thinking about international law as a kind of instrument of social justice, and instead think about what refugees themselves want on a much more specific and particular localized level.
Laura Robson, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Laura Robson is professor of history at Penn State University. We've been discussing Human Capital, A History of Putting Refugees to Work. That's published by Verso at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. Her other books include The Politics of Mass Violence in the Middle East, and she's co-founder and co-editor of Stateless Histories. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.